Hello and welcome to Splash of Cinema. I am your host, John Bodeman, and today we have two fabulous guests and fellow White Lotus aficionados to talk about season two of The White Lotus, what was a prolific season, the newest HBO release, the newest popular show, the newest critically acclaimed show, and we're just going to be talking about the season and what happened and maybe what's next. So, reactions, boys, welcome.
Hello, I'm William Bodeman. I have been on this podcast multiple times before. I am the host, John Bodeman's twin brother. And yeah, I think this show is very intrigue-filled, and I'm very excited to talk about it. Coop?
Yeah, hey, I'm Cooper Sepke. Second appearance on the pod. Very lucky and excited to be here. I'm a good friend of the Bodenmans, and I was thrilled with this season. Mike White is a king. And I just love what he brings to the table, so excited to talk about it.
So I think the storylines coming into this season, after the first one, I'll just give you guys a quick recap in the audience if you haven't seen The White Lotus before or know what it is. So it started out as an HBO limited series, and it was intended to be a limited series. It was up for Emmy nominations for limited series, and it was so well received, so popular, that they decided to make a second season. And Mike White was the guy that both wrote and directed the first season. That stayed the same. He wrote and directed the second season. So far, he's written and directed every single episode of The White Lotus. The second season was also unique in which, because it was set as a limited series, the first season, there was a whole new cast of characters in the second, but they brought one character played by the fantastic Jennifer Coolidge, who won an Emmy for it, through to the second season, along with her husband from the first. And of course, once again, in the second season, I didn't see it at first, but she ended up being one of the major characters. So once again, maybe it was Jennifer Coolidge's show this season. What do you boys think?
Boy, do I love Jennifer Coolidge. I was really glad she got brought back. Basically, the thing about The White Lotus is that the first scene of each season shows that someone has died. And then it rewinds to the week earlier, and we meet all these people, and basically we're trying to figure out who died. And throughout the show, it teases death. Mike White was on Survivor, and if you've ever seen Survivor, it's cut very similarly with music and shots of nature. And in season two, Jennifer Coolidge ends up being one of the victims. The first season, there was one death. Second season, there were a few. Jennifer Coolidge is kind of the most notable death. Mike White pulled off an all-time troll by saying, I think it was on a Reddit AMA, it might have been in an interview, where he said in the middle of the second season that he was not going to do the show for a third season unless Jennifer Coolidge was in the cast. So he trolled us there because obviously she cannot be in the third season. Well, I've seen theories that she's going to have a twin sister. But anyway, Jennifer Coolidge dies and she will not be joining us in season three. How did you guys feel about her character throughout the season and just her ultimate demise?
Actually, the interviews that they would show after some of the episodes adds a little context to this, because after the season's finale, I stuck around and watched the interview, and the director, Mike White, made it very clear that he had hinted at Tanya's death in season one, in that she said that her last great thing that she had to fulfill was death. I forget the specific scene, but she's talking to Greg, and they're talking about like big experiences. And she says that the last big experience that she needs to have is that of death. And Mike White took that into season two, knowing the entire time that she was going to be the one that died, and or one of the people that died. And then kind of, you know, as he does with all of the characters in the writing, kind of teases her death throughout the season, you know, in reference to the opera and all the vases and weird faces it shows shattering and blah, 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 blah. So this was really, this season was definitely kind of centered around Tanya's death and setting that up. But also, you know, another great thing about White Lotus is that it develops all of its characters very well. So if anyone wants to speak to that, but yeah.
Well, I'm just going to touch on that for a second, Will. I do think while Mike White did hint at Jennifer Coolidge's death, the whole point of what she was talking about in the first season was that she really wanted to like experience death. Like she wanted to make it like this whole transcendent thing. And the way that her death happened in the second season was just about the farthest you can get from that. I mean, she might have seen it coming, but then when she goes to climb into that boat, like she did not expect to just fall off, hit her head and drown. but it does milk it a little bit. And so I'll agree with you on that in the sense that like her body floats through the water and all that stuff. And it kind of showcases like Jennifer Coolidge ends up being the focal point of season two, kind of out of nowhere. Like she wasn't written as a strong character in the beginning. And so once again, I don't know, I feel like she took over. Although my MVP of the season had to be Aubrey Plaza.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, back to your point, just touching on Jennifer Coolidge's death. Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with you there in that it was very anticlimactic. But, you know, that's also the point in that he said in the interview after the show, Mike White said that he didn't want Jennifer Coolidge's character to get, like, to have a super tragic death, right? It, like, it was very funny in that the tragedy was the irony of her death and that, you know, she just escaped this big, like, murder plot against her and then, you know, dies in an accident because she's stupid and doesn't take the stairs down to the boat. But, you know, it's beyond that. He said that he didn't want to kill her in the manner of, like, this guy just, like, kills her and it's a clean death, because that would be even more tragic. White Lotus, of course, even in those pivotal murder scenes, just like it did in the last season with, you know, the hotel manager taking a shit in the one character's luggage before getting stabbed, it combines humor in its darkest moments. So yeah, that's just my response to that on Jennifer Coolidge's death. But
I do agree with you, but there weren't stairs down to the boat.
There were stairs down to the boat. It was very clear. How did you get up? How'd the guy get up then? Did he just climb up over the side? Do you just get off your boat and just climb up over the side?
That is a good point.
There were stairs. It was clear. In fact, the camera angle showed the stairs in that, you know, pivotal shot before she does end up falling to her death. So yeah, there were stairs, and I think that adds to the humor, of course.
And also just the fact that not just the stairs, she could have done a number of things differently. Taking her heels off, just jumping into the water and then trying to climb into the boat. Just literally anything other than trying to climb over a railing with her body type, wearing heels. It epitomized her as a character, just her lack of decision-making abilities. Although she is sneaky, smart, she did sniff out the plot. She obviously does have a lot of life experience, which she kind of alluded to in that ominous conversation that she had with Quentin when they were talking about beauty. Would you die for beauty? Yeah, I think there's a lot more to her as a character than her death.
On what you were saying, I have to shout out Tom Hollander as Quentin. Oh my gosh. Tom Hollander really carried that role. And I think you're right. Like, I remember specifically that kind of soliloquy he gives when he's talking about the beauty of, like, death, and specifically in relation to the opera. And her character's kind of like, the opera is a metaphor for her character's experience. And I think it follows that through to the end. It is kind of a tragic story, even though it may be a funny death. But anyway, I had meant to ask a question earlier and I didn't really pose it in the right way. Who is your MVP in terms of who was the best, the most outstanding actor and or actress of the season?
I might have to go with Albie's grandfather. I forget his name.
F. Murray Abraham.
Yeah. See, I think this season was different in that in the first season, I think we were kind of able to figure out earlier on what Mike White's message was and like what each character was kind of about. This season, you can see it with Daphne, with Albie, with F. Murray Abraham. At the beginning, we think of Albie as this, you know, nice guy. He's different. Like, we think of, who else did I say?
Daphne
as this poor, like, helpless, she's trapped in this relationship. And then it turns out she's playing 3D chess. It turns out Albie's just as shitty as his forefathers. But yeah, F. Murray Abraham, just his arc. And I really thought he was going to die in the last episode separately from the head wound, just because that speech he gives in the penultimate episode at the end, at dinner, where he's crying about their little botched reunion, that just seemed like a goodbye speech. I really thought he just wasn't going to wake up from a brain bleed or something. His character was just so funny, but at the same time, tragic. He really kind of represents that like generational passing down of being a shitty man. Because if the first season was about class and race, this season was about masculinity, infidelity, and the things that go along with that. So I think he was kind of like the crux of that.
Yeah, definitely one of the cruxes. It explores all sorts of different sexual relationships, but in that family, yes, the passing down is very evident, especially, you know, in one of those final shots. All those guys are in the airport, hot chick walks by, they all stare at her ass in unison as a family. It's easy to see that generational divide still continuing to have the same sort of behavioral patterns. But yeah, John, what do you think about F. Murray Abraham? Did you like his performance?
Well, yeah, and actually, like, coming into this season, I knew the cast. I didn't know exactly how much screen time each of them would have, but I assumed F. Murray Abraham would be a prominent figure in the series. If you just look at the acting credits of the cast, he is the most accomplished of anyone. I mean, he has won an Academy Award for Best Actor. I don't know if either of you guys have seen Amadeus, but he's fantastic in that film. Will's rolling his eyes. It is a great movie. And he doesn't even play Mozart, and he won Best Actor. So if you can just keep that in context, he's kind of disappeared from the scene for a while, but I'm glad he came back in this. And to Mike White's credit, to whoever the producers are, to their credit, in both seasons of The White Lotus, they've taken a number of both accomplished and unaccomplished actors and meshed them really well into two fantastic ensemble casts. And aside from F. Murray Abraham, I mean, you have plenty of other accomplished actors in this. Aubrey Plaza is a great example. Theo James, another. But a lot of them played roles that are like very different from what they normally play. And so then you get to see them in different contexts. But to your point, Will, F. Murray Abraham, yeah, I mean, he's a fantastic actor. He was literally the top in his field for a year. So what I can say is I wasn't surprised that he had a fantastic performance. I think they actually gave him maybe less screen time than his character deserved, but he still made the most of it. And he was, oddly enough, perhaps the biggest source of comic relief in this season, especially because this season was much darker than the first. So those are my thoughts on him.
Will, who's your MVP?
That's a tough question. Probably Daphne, I would say. I think she's very good at portraying some of those subtle nuances in the show that a lot of the other actors aren't, because a lot of the other characters are designed to be more explicit in their language and, you know, their threats and that sort of behavioral manner. But her behavior provides a lot of intrigue because, you know, she never outright says what she's implying. She's a very sneaky person, and you can kind of see, you know, as Coop said earlier, why she has her character change throughout the show. And, you know, in fact, it's not a change at all. It's just the way that the viewer depicts her. But she is very ruthless and self-fulfilling in a lot of ways that you start to see with her subtle acting. And, you know, I just love that final scene in the last episode where her and Ethan go to the island. And you never really know what happened, but you can kind of tell just because she's so great at implying the things that have happened that she's done in her life, just in like subtle acting, subliminal messaging.
Yeah, I think you're right there, Will. And a lot of people, like, this is one of the biggest sources of debate after each White Lotus episode. In various different episodes, Daphne implies different things. So like the first stance in which she implies something to Harper is she implies that she cheats on her husband. She says, I beat him in like my own ways, or I get back out of my own ways. She never says like I cheat on my husband, but it's there. Then the next time she shows a photo of her children to Harper, and it's clear that there's a chance that the children are not of her husband. They're with her personal trainer. And the third one, perhaps the most obvious, is when she walks off with Ethan after he's worried that Harper had sex with Theo, right? Or Theo James' character, sorry. So that was going to be my next question to you guys, because honestly, I'm torn. I assume they had sex, but do you think when Harper and Ethan went off together that they had sex? And if so, do you think that's why Ethan suddenly feels on top of the world, reclaimed his masculinity, etc.?
Yeah, I think you mean Daphne and Ethan, but you said Harper. Okay, I will answer, but I first want to say that I think the point was of both the relationship between Harper and Cam and Ethan and Daphne, I think the point was to not tell us explicitly, because I think what Mike White was advancing about relationships, or about those specific relationships, was that trust is kind of an illusion. Ethan and Harper went into this vacation not really having any apparent problems, But because of this illusion that Ethan, because Ethan saw them flirting and because they went up to Harper's room, you know, that distrust is sown. And because, you know, the condom that was found, and Ethan gives that whole speech, like, you should be proud of me. I am good in this situation. I think the whole point was creating that illusion that plagues so many relationships in terms of trust. But I am going to go ahead and say that they absolutely had sex. I will say that Harper and Cam, I really hope they did not have sex. I think they would have anyway if Ethan didn't end up coming up to the room. I don't know. I'm a little possessive over Aubrey Plaza. But yeah, I think that Ethan and Daphne absolutely. I mean, the look she was giving him, she turns around and looks him up and down once, and then she does it again. That acting was just phenomenal. It's kind of undeniable what was going through their minds there.
Yeah, I agree. They definitely banged. And all the sort of subliminal messaging, as I had just previously said, in the actors' responses to each other certainly indicates that as such. And especially just sort of Ethan's mentality and mindset throughout the show, I think something significant would have needed to happen to erase that jealousy to the level that it did. And fucking the other dude's wife, like, that's definitely something that would make almost anyone feel better in that situation, you know, with Ethan's suspicions that he had and the sort of power struggle between him and Cam. So I think, yeah, they definitely had sex.
Now, there was another thing as well that I wanted to ask you boys. Because the way that the conclusion is done, there's just so many kind of open-ended questions that the viewer has, especially reflecting on the season. And when I think of Albie and his relationship with Lucia, I had kind of naively assumed that maybe Lucia had changed in a way. And of course, in the end, she does play him. She takes the money. But she kind of gives that look back, like, I feel bad. Do you think she did feel bad for Albie, or do you think the whole plan was all along to play him?
I think that was the plan all along. I think she said it at one point to her friend when she said, this might be our chance. I think it was, like, on the beach or something. She it was vague, but she said, like, you know, this might finally be our chance. And at first I thought, oh, maybe it's like her chance to move to LA with him. But really it was just to get money the whole time. But I don't know, that scene at the end where I think the guy's name was Alessio, who posed as the pimp, and he turned out to just be a hotel employee or something. I liked that scene. That made me feel good, just because you kind of zoom out and realize there's a whole other side to this. There's a whole underbelly of, you know, people who don't just have $50,000 to tell their dad, give me it. Like, that scene was also crazy. Him just, like, completely turning to the dark side and saying, give it to me. Like, and, like, such a spoiled, rotten little brat. And then ultimately his dad decides to do it because he threatened him, or no, he offered him to talk to his mom.
I knew that was coming too. Like, I knew it, you know, when as soon as he approaches the table, I'm like, he's going to offer to, like, completely cave in on all his beliefs for this $50,000. Crazy.
Yeah, just crazy that that would even be something that would go through his head in the first place. Because immediately he's like, he makes a joke out of it. And he's like, oh, yeah, let me just wire transfer the money now. And then within 2 minutes, he's like, definitely going to do it. And that scene was just sad. I feel like as a viewer, I was looking at it like, this is a sex worker that you met less than a week ago. Of course she's going to run away with that money.
And, you know, the dad was a pig. Like, I will absolutely agree. Disgusting character. But he was right, ultimately, in the end. Like, he had that wisdom to know, because he's probably been around a number of sex workers, that you're going to get played. He called it. As soon as he said it, I'm like, all right, the dad knows his shit. And then it ended up being sad for Albie. But he didn't even really seem to care, like, that much. Like, he immediately goes to the airport and finds Portia. I figured, like, as soon as they got split apart, there were warning signs that each of their new partners had, like, insane red flags. Those red flags, of course, manifested, and suddenly they end up back together. So I just want to applaud Mike White for that relationship, writing that whole thing. I think the whole arc played well. But Portia was kind of one of my least favorite characters. Like, I just don't think she was very likable. What do you boys think?
Yeah, no, I definitely didn't like her at all. I thought that her rhetoric and her action were very divorced from each other. And that was kind of annoying. Like, you know, she was, instead of embracing her experiences and sort of going with the flow and, you know, looking at things positively, she was kind of harping on the experience the whole time. I mean, granted, there was some justification that I'm sure Jennifer Coolidge would be an annoying boss, but, you know, that's definitely why she liked that love interest so much more than Albie, because the guy was very in the moment and, like, trying to enjoy life as much as he could in the moments that he had. And that's definitely what was missing from her character, which kind of made her a bummer. And she was kind of stupid, and that she didn't really realize until too late what was going on with her boss and, you know, why that situation was a little odd. She probably should have been a little more on guard in that time period. But yeah, definitely an interesting character. I thought the acting was phenomenal. And yeah, I didn't like Portia very much, but I'm certainly glad that she survived the endeavor and I'm sure learned a couple lessons along the way.
Yeah. When Jennifer Coolidge wakes up the next day, I think it was after she saw what the male sex worker, you know, banging Quentin.
Jack.
Yeah, Jack. And she makes a comment about Portia being, like, reminding her of herself. And in that last airport scene, Portia's putting on the crazy sunglasses, like, trying to, almost, like, she's trying to disguise herself because she knows something went down. And I just thought to myself, that's some shit Jennifer Coolidge's character would do. She would be in an airport putting on the most extravagant sunglasses as, like, a disguise. It just kind of made me realize there's a lot of parallels between them in terms of just, like, naivety and, you know, kind of not having, just kind of having, like, the minimum level of awareness to survive.
That's a good point, too. Like, Portia complains a lot about the world and about her bosses, but she, like, definitely mirrors Jennifer Coolidge in a lot of ways. Like, before you said that, I didn't even think about it that much, but it's so true. Like, towards the end of the show, she's just, like, she's kind of a hedonist in a way, but also, like, if she was rich, she would be the same as Jennifer Coolidge. I just know it. She would be very demanding if she got her own assistant, you know? She's a very needy person, and she relies on Jack for a lot, and she should have assumed, like, from the get-go, the way that Jack behaves, she's absolutely incompatible with him. Because over and over again, she complains about, like, work or whatever, and Jack's just like, okay, like, let's go have fun, you know? And I knew that his character was fake, especially after Jennifer Coolidge sees him having, like, butt sex with his uncle. But in the end, I end up really liking Jack because he frees Portia, and I just have to assume that that was not the assignment. I assume the assignment was he takes her back to the hotel and someone knocks her off. But he didn't. He took her to the airport and he said, don't ever worry about this again, forget about it, and go. So my question would be, do you agree with me? Do you think that Jack's character was supposed to take her to the airport? Or do you think he was supposed to take her home?
I don't think he was supposed to take her to the airport. I also don't think she was supposed to be killed. I think she was just supposed to be taken back. And I think maybe even Jack did this maliciously because he knew that Portia was catching on. And taking her back would have put his uncle in danger. Or not his uncle, but, you know, his employer, his pimp, in danger. Because I think maybe he realized Portia knew too much and that she knew something was going on. So he was kind of doing it to save them. Let me just drop her off at the airport, convince her not to fuck with these people, and it'll go away. Because I really disagree with you in terms of liking Jack. I never liked him, even at the end when he dropped her off at the airport. There's just something about him. At that first scene when he gets in the pool while Albie and Portia are having that awkward-ass kiss, he gets in the pool and he's like, oh, my nips are chilly or whatever. He's just kind of like a brute, like a brutal, just like man to his core. Like the beer drinking and the burping and the, oh, I gotta take a shit. Like, I just really disliked him, and I don't think he was doing that out of the kindness of his heart.
Yeah, I mean, just to touch on what you were talking about, Coop, I think Jack, though, like, he might have been a little bit arrogant and kind of a little bit of a prick. It feels like he was almost hopeless, though. Like, there was nothing he could do. It felt like he was trapped. And especially towards the end when he knows that Portia knows, like, the way that he talks is kind of like, you just need to get the fuck out of here. Like, there's nothing I can do about it. Like, it's unfortunate. Like, I don't know if the guy's really gay or bi or whatever, but it seemed like he was stuck in a situation that he couldn't get out of. And so at first, he was definitely a douche. Like, that opening pool scene, not a good vibe. Like, not the good opener that you would want for a character. Especially because at that point, you were rooting for Albie and Portia to have a relationship. He went from, like, this fantastic character, this nice guy, to the biggest asshole ever, and then kind of redeemable in a way. And so I liked his character arc. I think he had more of an arc than most. But yeah, that's just my thoughts. Will, did you have anything to touch on for that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I never really liked him much as a character. I think he was very one-dimensional from the start. And there was some dynamicism in that they sort of discussed... I don't like that look, John. But yeah, in which they sort of discussed his past and how he was kind of shuttled into the situation, like you said, where you sort of feel a little bit of empathy for him, but overall, absolutely not. I did not like his character. Just not dynamic enough for me, especially in contrast to all the other roles. He was sort of painted as a villain. And do I think that he purposely took Portia to the airport instead of killing her? No. Like, I don't think he was ever supposed to kill her. Maybe his bluntness was an act of kindness, because it would have been good for her to get away from that whole situation. But yeah, not a huge fan of the guy.
Yeah, also that the whole plot that they had to kill Tanya, they were all, Greg included, the gays, and Jack, were all sloppy as fuck. Like, Greg freaking out when Portia's there in the first place. The gays making all those comments about, like, I think they said, like, oh, this could be your last day or whatever. Whatever that those comments were at the breakfast. Them, Tanya walking in on them whispering, the picture of Greg being out with Quentin. Like, they were just sloppy throughout the whole thing. And Jack especially, you can tell he wasn't taking it seriously. Whenever Portia would say, I have to go home, he wouldn't come up with anything. He would just be, like, drunk and be like, no, like, it'll be fine. Like, he was just kind of half-assing it. But I also have to be reminded that Portia was not supposed to be there. She was not supposed to be part of this plot. So Jack was definitely a late addition. I'm sure Quentin knew him beforehand, but he was definitely, like, a late addition to that whole plan. But, yeah, I was just surprised at the sloppiness. I think it goes to show, like, how much of an idiot Greg really is.
Greg? You really think Greg is the one to blame for that whole how the plot got fucked up there?
I don't think he's to blame that it got fucked up, but I think he was not meticulous enough. He was not careful enough. It was too telling. And I think that part of that was underestimating Tanya's intelligence. If you're going to swindle hundreds of millions of dollars from someone, you know, you really got to be careful about it.
And while you do love Tanya, like, even in season one, and you know Tanya, like, Jennifer Coolidge is a great actress. She plays the role well. But the character of Tanya is, like, shitty. And, like, you would think, really? Like, would anyone marry that lady? Would anyone want to spend time with her? Because she's completely self-involved, right? So when Greg comes through in season one, you're like, oh my gosh, like, this is almost too good to be true. Like, why would some guy want to spend all of his time with her, like, without wanting her money? And then as soon as he mentions her not signing the prenup in the second season, this new season, immediately what comes to your mind is Greg cares about money. And so in that way, I think, like, he is kind of smart, because from the beginning, he planned her, he successfully, like, honeypotted her. And at that point, he just passed on the whole plan to his old accomplice. So I don't know if Greg's the one to blame, necessarily. I think Quentin's the one to blame. Like, why would you create a situation in which Tanya could walk in on you and see you having gay sex with your supposed nephew? But anyway, all that aside, what I think is interesting is in both season one and two, he made the, like, hotel managers, who are vastly different. Like, the dynamic is different in both, but he made them LGBTQ, right? And so in season two, you have someone that's, like, just exploring her sexuality kind of for the first time. And in season one, clearly Murray Abraham was very different. So that's the one dynamic, like, we haven't really talked about. I wanted to kind of take your guys' thoughts on this. The one arc we haven't really talked about so far is the hotel manager and the employees arc. Like, how do you think they were portrayed differently in season two compared to season one?
You know, I'll take that. So as Mike White has said, the main theme of season one is money, and the main theme of season two is sex. So in terms of incorporating the workers more into the plot and giving them bigger roles compared to the guests, I think that the first season definitely featured the workers into the plot in more integral ways a lot more. So, yeah, no, I mean, definitely with the hotel manager, the hotel manager winning the Oscar for best supporting actor last season, or not the Oscar, excuse me.
And that was the Murray
Golden
Abraham.
Globe. Yeah, Murray Abraham winning the Oscar for or the Golden Globe, excuse me. We're going to edit this part out, so it doesn't matter.
His name is not Murray Abraham.
I think in season one, like I said, with it being about money and sort of differences in class.
Oh, no, it was Murray Bartlett.
Yeah, with it being about money and differences in class, I think it featured the hotel workers a lot more, especially with Jennifer Coolidge and her plot in regards to the one hotel worker and the hotel workers finding the bag of drugs. They were just more integral. And, of course, the hotel worker stealing the jewelry out of the safe from the one family in season one. All of those scenes sort of illustrate the cohesion of the workers with the cast, like the cast of guests more in season one. In season two, it was less so. I would say the workers had more of a relationship with the locals. The two prostitute women. But in terms of their relationship with the guests, it was never anything crazy. Like, there was no real conflict between the guests and the staff at any time. I mean, they still gave some drama in terms of the intrigue with this season's hotel manager and her liking of the one employee. And, you know, that employee being engaged. And, yeah, there was a little bit of strife among hotel staff, but not nearly as much guest staff reaction in this season as there was in the first season. Coop, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think to go back to your first comment, season one's about money. Season two is about sex. And the workers reflect each of those themes. In the first season, we have a lot of the workers are, you know, indigenous Hawaiians. And this hotel kind of like came in and stole their land. Besides the young guy who gets his ass eaten by Murray Bartlett, he was white. But yeah, I think like that was more reflective of the theme of money and class. While the workers this season were older, we have the relationship between Rocco and the female host or front desk lady. You know, that's about sex. That's about Valentina, the hotel manager, wants to fuck her. She, you know, has a relationship with Rocco. So I think the workers were reflective of the themes of the seasons.
Yeah, I think another interesting dynamic specifically with Valentina this season was the fact that, like, in the beginning she was praised for being, like, an independent woman and not, like, listening to other people's needs, just kind of being, like, the strong manager that was needed. And then immediately, like, as soon as she has sex with the young singer, she gives her the job over the old season veteran. And that guy was disgusting, like, don't get me wrong. He's one of the least likable characters in the season. But do you think Valentina, like, completely compromised all that she stood for in the name of sex?
No. Well, yeah, but I don't think she, like, stood for anything in the first place. I just think she kind of, like, you know, put that face on. But I think it's interesting if you look at Murray Bartlett and then Valentina. Like, Murray Bartlett, like, the bane of his existence is his addiction. Like, that's what ends up actually killing him. Like, he's a fantastic manager outside of that. And I think with Valentina, it's the same. She's a good manager outside of her obsession with her sexual attraction to her employee. And I think those two, the addiction in the first season and then just kind of, like, the horniness in the second season, that's what brings these characters down to their lowest moments. And that's kind of like what ruins them as people and also shows how they're terrible at their jobs.
Another question for both of you after the season, because there are several unanswered questions. Something that I was wondering is back to the whole Portia, Jack, Tanya plot. Do you think Portia would ever end up saying anything about what she heard and what she saw and how Tanya died? Or do you think she would just kind of leave it alone and move on with her life?
Yeah, I think, Will, you mentioned that you watched the post-credit interviews, and I think Mike White says he addresses the question of, oh, is Greg gonna get off scot-free? Like, is Greg just going to get all this money, or is it going to get traced back to him? And Mike White says it'll probably get traced back to Greg and he'll get in trouble. So I think Portia will be inevitably approached by law enforcement. And I don't think she will implicate Jack personally. Like, I don't think she would do that because I think she's grateful to him for dropping her off at the airport. But I think she'll talk. I don't see why she wouldn't. I can't really think of anything besides just the embarrassment of getting caught in that plot and not realizing it. What do you guys think?
Do you think that'll be a part of season three, or are we just supposed to assume kind of what happens?
No, I think the series is anthological in nature, and that each season is going to be its own contained storyline. The only touches to the past will be if there's any recurring characters, or I'm sure that in the next season someone will mention in a quip that, like, oh, this is the third White Lotus where guests have died or whatever, some shit like that. But so much of it is meant to be left up to interpretation, including that whole aspect of, you know, how the cops are going to deal with everything after. Because the other funny part about Tanya's death is that I'm sure, like you said, there are some ways to implicate Greg somehow, but Greg's plot did work, just not in, like, the way he intended. Like, she did die, like, that was the goal. Like, he'll get the prenup money as long as they don't trace any foul play back to him. But, yeah, like, she did still die, and, you know, there is a lot of intrigue around that. But there's a lot of intrigue everywhere, and, you know, there was intrigue last season, too. But they'll go into the next season with a fresh slate, I'm sure. So that, which, you know, that leads me to a question. Where do you guys think that the next White Lotus will be?
Ocean City, Maryland.
Asia. Ocean City, Maryland would absolutely be hilarious. I don't know. It wouldn't be that fancy, but no. Asia. Mike White has also said, like, he wants to do it in Asia. He said he thought about doing it in Asia, like, this season. If you just think about, like, giving different representation to parts of the world, I guess Hawaii is, like, technically America, even though it's almost kind of Asia.
You say a lot of questionable things, but yeah.
You don't think, I mean, Hawaii is the Pacific. It'd be the same as, like, almost Guam, or, like climate-wise, setting-wise, it's almost the same as Southeast Asia.
Yeah, no, that's...
Perhaps I'm saying something that's super offensive, but, like, if Hawaii wasn't part of the United States, it would be considered an Asian, like, Pacific island. So.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's going to be somewhere like Thailand or like Singapore or somewhere in Southeast Asia, perhaps Vietnam. Those are all very popular tourist destinations, cool resorts. And if you've noticed, like, each season, like, focuses on a different theme. So the first season was about the power dynamics within, like, money, differences in money. The second season was definitely, like, very sexual. It was about the power dynamics within sex, sexual relationships. This third season, Mike White has said he wants to make about spirituality. So all I'm basing this is on stuff Mike White has said. But he has not only expressed an interest in Asia, but also in, like, exploring different religions and spirituality. And I think, like, different cultures within Asia have a lot to offer in terms of differences within spirituality, especially within, like, wealth, like, class systems. India would be, like, a great, like, interesting example. So that's just my thoughts. Coop?
No, I think that's, I didn't know about Mike White's spirituality comments, but I think that's really cool. I think that some sort of, like, religious retreat, or not religious, but some sort of spiritual retreat to a White Lotus could bring a lot of freaky white people into the cast, which, you know, is always what makes the show, the, like, just crazy, dumb white people. But to, like, kind of pivot to my dream, this is not a prediction, this is my dream, but a White Lotus cruise, I think, would just bring so much to the table, that the idea of a confined space in the middle of the ocean would just bring a lot of attention in itself that I think is fitting for the series. And I also think there's a lot you can explore with cruise ship workers who are, like, famously treated like shit. So that's my dream, is a cruise. But yeah, the your ideas seem cool.
Will, what do you have to say about this? What's your prediction for White Lotus season 3? Where do you think it's gonna happen?
Yeah, I mean, I probably would have said Asia too, but, you know, just to throw different perspective here, I didn't even think about the cruise ship. I think that'd be really cool. But it'd also be really cool if it was in, like, a super cold, almost Arctic-like environment, you know, maybe a ski resort or something of that nature. I think they likely shy away from Europe for a while just because of the most recent season, which was set in Italy. But if they could find their way into the mountain somewhere in some illustrious resort, I think that would be really cool. Or, you know, maybe there'll be some sort of White Lotus adventure type trip, you know, where they all go camping or something. I'm sure it'd be glamping or something wealth oriented. But, you know, there's a million different things that they can do with a group of people. But yeah, I'm definitely sold on that that cruise idea. I think that's great. But who knows? Maybe if it's spiritual, it'll be like some religious site, like Japan or something like that, with a lot of ancient religious history.
Yeah, I have faith in Mike White no matter what. So.
Oh, do you have faith in Mike White?
Get it? He has earned my trust.
Now, Wilk, I know we've talked about this a couple times, so I just wanted to ask you, did your opinions on Mia change? Because you said you like didn't really like her at all at the beginning of the season.
No, I did not like either of the prostitutes. I just didn't.
I hated Lucia, like, to be honest. But I thought Mia wasn't, like...
Mia almost killed a guy, though, and did nothing.
But it was such an accident. It was such an accident. She did give... Actually, I guess it wasn't an accident, because she gave him both pills. She knew one was a Molly and one was a Viagra.
Yes.
And I thought he was going to die, but he didn't. He just came back. Do you think that that guy's going to eventually, like, sue the White Lotus and try to come back?
Maybe. I don't know. They're definitely not going to reveal it. Like, it's the Italy shit done. But, yeah, it's definitely interesting to think about all these tangents, John. There's a lot of what-ifs. That's a cool part of the show. But, yeah, in general, I don't know. It's just that sort of behavior throughout. They were just never super redeemable in any way. Like, although I thought it was cool how she gave a lesbian awakening to the one hotel manager. Like, that was neat. But obviously, you know, it was also for her personal gain. So in a way, she wasn't really a prostitute, but she also was, because though she wasn't doing it for money necessarily as much as Lucia, she was doing it for influence and to get her shot in music, and which I don't even know, like, playing hotel piano, like, I don't know where that would get her. So I didn't really understand that plot line a whole lot, but it was still, like, it was cool. There was some intrigue there.
I'll counter that. I kind of disagree. I think Mia was doing it because she just loved music, and that's all she wanted in life was to play. I don't think it was to become, like, a superstar or anything. And also, if you look at the two people she fucked to get where she wanted to go, I mean, it was that skeevy old piano player who was just annoying and terrible, and then the hotel manager who was completely blinded by her lesbian horniness, and, like, she kind of, like, took advantage of those situations to chase after something that she, like, genuinely wanted and loved. Lucia, on the other hand, is scamming people out of money. Lucia's not doing it because she loves, like, being a sex worker. She's not doing it to, like, chase after any sort of passion. She's just doing it for money, which is respectable because she has to make a living. But I definitely liked Mia way more than Lucia.
And I agree. I mean, I would have said that from the beginning. I think you could get a pretty good read on those characters, like, an episode or two in. And they weren't really dynamic in any sense. Like, they didn't really change. They had the same motivations, and they followed through on them. Now, in the interest of time, and because I know this might soon head off the rails, I'm going to ask one final question that I'm going to pose to you boys. Because I do think this has been a good conversation about, so far, what has evolved during the second season and maybe what's to come. Comparing the first season, which has already been critically acclaimed, won a bunch of Emmys, to the second season is hard. Now, I know they're very different, they have different casts, but they have the same writing and they have the same director. So, how do you compare them, and what was better from the first to the second, and why? And personally, like, I'll just say, I thought the second season was much darker, but in fact, it was maybe even better television than the first. And I think Mike White took more risks and liberties with this one. I also think the cast, even though the first season was an Emmy-winning cast, this second season might have been a better overall cast. I think each character tried really hard, and from the first to second, all the way through the end of episodes, the number of times that, like, my MVP of the season, my best actor, changed was pretty ridiculous. I think several actors in this case turned in the best performances of their career. So, yeah, I just want to gauge you boys. Like, how do you think the first compared to the second? And what was better, what was worse?
Yeah, I think both seasons were great, first of all, but I did like season two better. both seasons were very subtle, but like I think season two was even more subtle and like way more tense, as you said, with that darkness. Like just the tenseness that was present in each little conversation that happened. It was a lot less reliant on like big action scenes, and it was more reliant on the little conversations. And I think in nature it was about, you know, sex and personal relationships. So there was a lot more importance in each little conversation and each little microaggression that each character goes through. But I definitely thought season two was more dynamic. It was more intense. It was more subtle. And there was a lot more to look for as a viewer. There's a lot more to pay attention to, a lot more layers. And I can only hope season three will get even better. Will?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with everything that you guys have been saying. I'll also say that season two was better overall, in my opinion, just because I am a sucker for psychological thriller-oriented shows and, you know, just the higher level of intrigue in general of season two compared to season one. But yeah, overall, I think that the weight of season two was a little heftier as well, just because you knew that four people died, so instead of just the one in season one. So there was certainly more intrigue surrounding the death of the character specifically, but also I thought the theme of sex was much more compelling because, you know, they didn't really need to do that much more money-based satire anymore in season two, because if you are a loyal watcher of White Lotus, which I feel like a lot of people are, then, you know, you've obviously seen season one before you have season two, and that kind of theme of wealth is well established. Like, it does carry over into the second season, and that you again see how, like, these rich people are kind of naive in a lot of ways to the local culture, and they pay the price for it. But this season was much more about, you know, all the sex and the intrigue surrounding that. Like, even if there was no presumed instance of the characters hooking up at a certain point in the show, like, there was still the intrigue of this is going to happen. But I just think that season two was certainly, as John said, darker, but more suspenseful overall, and very good. And hopefully that trend continues. It's going to be tough to keep producing this sort of television, but I think that Mike White is very capable.
I would completely agree with what you said, Will. I love the ending on the optimistic note. From the first to the second season, I did doubt Mike White a little bit. I thought, can he recreate the magic? And definitely he did. Every episode was full of suspense, and I was watching it every week. And by the end, I was like, wow, like Mike White kind of really had me for a loop there. And I thought it was a great season of television. I think HBO, oddly enough, continues to be the forefront of television and the best in TV, the best of what TV has to offer. And I applaud them for it. I think maybe comparatively to other streaming services, other companies, they care more about the quality of products and it pays off. So I really enjoyed White Lotus season two. I want to thank you boys both for coming on to talk about it, because I think it was kind of an important season to not address on the podcast. And although maybe some of our listeners don't watch it, I think it's cool that we're talking about it. So thank you both for coming on. Have a great holiday break. I love you boys. I'm going to wrap it up. So that was Splash of Cinema, signing off, John Boderman.
Will Boderman, number one guest and number one commentator on the pod.
And Cooper Stepke.
The legends themselves.
Sexiest guest on the pod. Thank you for having me.